you had a brewery book, and Bone Oldham had a brewery book, and you were joined. Were you dealing in the same stocks?
Oh, no. As I say, after the brewery book was split there, after brewery book we had, but they were different stocks. We never had the never had the same stocks. And we used to have one partner, going back to get early 50s, a chap named Jerome Briggs. He used to run one book only, and that was distiller book. And he used to do a lot of business in distiller book, but he always took Friday the 13th off. Always. Mm-hmm. As long as I ever knew. And apparently the reason being, when one Friday the 13th he came up, I don't know how long ago it was or when, it cost him a lot of money. So he decided then he'd never come up again on the Friday the 13th, and he never did for the rest of his life. Mm. It's incredible. But it was such a wonderful crowd.
Do you have any other memories of the partners in the firm at that time? Because I assume it was still a relatively small firm in the early 50s.
Yes, but it's not really, but it soon started to get big.
Mm. Was Esmond Durlacher the senior partner at that
time? He was the senior partner, and well, I suppose anybody works for a senior partner will say he's the best.
Mm.
And I'll go along with ours and say he was the best. And I'm pretty sure he wasn't far short of the best, if nothing else. But just to me, or to us in the firm, he was absolutely first class, and he knew his job inside out. His son works there now. That he was absolutely first class.
Again, for similar reasons that Pat Durlacher was.
Well, I never conversed with him to that extent.
Yes.
You know, but he'd always pass the time of day. He'd always ask how things are going. So, you know, and I think the whole firm got on very well with everybody. But of course, you know, he was away on business a hell of a lot of time.
Mm.
You know, with meetings and one thing another, being in business. And so, you know, although we didn't see him that much in the latter years, he never really did a lot of jobbing at the time, you know.
Mm.
So, but apart from the rest of them, they were just, well, everyday people, really, you know, with a job to do and knew how to do it. Came from the right school, all of them came from the right school, I suppose. And to do it.
Can you remember the pitch that you were first standing on with Pat Durlacher? Were you by one of these pillars?
Oh yes, we're by one of these pillars.
What part of the building?
Right in the middle of the building. Mm. I mean, when it was demolished, it was the mining market was demolished first. Well, we were still standing in there. And yes, we were more or less smack in the middle, right under the dome.
Mm.
So it was absolutely terrific, you know.
How many were with you on that particular book?
There's only Pat Durlacher and myself. You know, we used to have books like that. Michael Bennett was another man, young, very go ahead. And he was fantastic. He helped, you know, he helped me. And I can't remember now who else was there. Michael Bennett, Pat Durlacher, myself. No, I think that was the three of us used to be on this book, on the industrial book when it first started.
Mm.
But as I say, you know, it didn't stay sort of 20 stocks for long. It used to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm.
And then this went up to 1970, and we were a pretty sized firm at 1970. And I got the offer of a partnership, which was really...
How did that come about? Have to wait a long time for it.
Well, I mean, it was never going to come, because prior to that, I forgot to mention, prior to that, you see, I used to be on a sort of a bonus, depending on a percentage, on what money the firm made. And the offer of the partnership came because... maybe I was pretty good at what I was doing, you know, and because it didn't happen too often. There was one, two, three of us who, what I would call, came not didn't come from relatives and friends, you know, and I was the second one to be offered the parts, yeah. Which obviously, you know, I grabbed.
Mm.
I grabbed with two hands because, well, it was unheard of. It wasn't even in my way of life whatsoever. Mm. But it came and I accepted it and, well, it worked as far as I was concerned.
Did your role in the firm change in any way?
No, no, I did exactly the same job. Except that I then had people with me. You know, and I tried to teach them what the jobbing system was and how to do it. But it's not easy to teach anybody anything. It's a flair, I suppose, really, what you're born with. You know, or not maybe not born with, but it's something that you pick up. I mean, for example, when I first started dealing. Everybody used to make the, well, not first time, in the last first 5 or 7 years, 10 years. Everybody used to make prices in fives, tens, 25s and 50s. You know. And I thought, well, this, you know, we're all doing the same thing. So I decided I would change the system in as much that instead of making it in 25, I'd make it in 37 and a half or 62 and a half or whatever, you know. You know, this went down hilarious, actually, really, because nobody couldn't understand what it was. And then there's another thing about it, of course. You make 3 6 and 25, and somebody says, what did I then, 150,000? You make an entirely different price together. You know, nothing to do with 3 6. I mean, there could be sort of 37 40 instead of 33 6, you know, and 150,000, depending on which way you felt the market was going to go. And trying to sort of course to read the man who wanted to do the business, which was a lot of it, you see. Well, now you can't teach people that. That can only come by sitting and watching, you know, and try and pick it up from there. And that's why I think that I must have had a flair for something like that. Well, it was a flair for gambling, possibly, because that's all the business really was. But then again, you see, in those days, the market weren't bad. You either had a bull market for 3 4 5 7 years, and you had a bear market 2 3 4 5 years. You know, and the only thing to try and judge was when you think the time was going to come and change from bull to bear, or vice versa. But it never really showed itself, so you know, one had to be very careful from that point of view. But you can reckon once the bull market starts, it goes on for 2 or 3 years anyway. Mm. And you adjust your prices for that, and you can, you know, you run your books accordingly. Mm.
Do you have any recollections of times when you made that decision to go from being a bull?
Not really, no, I don't think one can say that. Because, I mean, was it 1974? The bull market more or less stopped overnight, and the bear market started, and quite a few people caught on the hop, and possibly including myself. But you can, you know, but then when you get the limit, the buyers used to buy on the way down, so you can always get yourself in a position to be a bear by selling the stock. As fellow said, well, you know, you make 3 6. He said, well, I'll give 300 for stock, you know, 3036. And he said, well, I'll give 300 for stock. Well, then it's up to you, say, what, you either sell them to him. You see, and then you call the thing 295.8. You know, it was, we can't tell people that, you see, unless they can sit there and watch it go on. Mm. It's impossible to tell them. But I feel that I did tell one or two people, you know, how to do the business, and they made a go of it. But it's not easy to tell them, because unless, as I say, it's a sort of a business where it's a gambling thing, and you've got to take the gamble, and it's not easy when it's vast sums of money involved.
Mm. Do you have any recollections when you took a gamble and it was very successful?
Well, yes, I have actually, but I mean, I did some business with a firm of brokers there many years ago in a stock called Burmid Industries, and I was short. And then the market kept going up and up and up. And I kept selling them. And eventually I kept selling them 50,000 a time on certain rising prices, you know, and I was getting myself in one hell of a mess. And I was, to be honest with you, I was a hell of a mess. And I thought, well, I can't be no worse a mess than what I'm in now. So I went out there one day and I said, Berman, I said, well, I think I'm not far wrong now. I'll offer you 50,000 at £1, whatever it was, £1.37, I think, something like that. So I said, I'll wait for an answer if I can. So I waited for an answer. And we don't want them. No, he was the only man I had who was buying them. Oh. So I went back to my pitch, you know, and waited 10 minutes or so. And went back out again. And I said, well, look, I'll offer you 50 Berman at 132. Let me know. So I went back on, nothing happened. So then the next day, I was still in one hell of a mess. I mean, I'll be absolutely honest, it was a terrible mess. I forget how many I was short of. So the next day, I went back again and offered him some more lower down. And in the finish, I hadn't dealt, and I'd got the thing down to 125. And there I was, sitting very nice and pretty there, and I started to make money, and they went down and down. He just wasn't interested. But that was, may have been luck, it's obviously a bit of luck there. But I wasn't afraid. Once I got myself into a hell of a mess, another 50,000 didn't make any difference, you know, wouldn't have made any difference to me. And there it was, and that was one that came off, and that was one that came off.
Do you recall any that didn't come off?
Oh, yes, quite a few didn't come off. Well, quite a few came, and, you know. Yeah. I always reckon that if you could hit 7 right out of 10, then you must make money, unless the 3 that you didn't cost you a colossal fortune. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you must make money out of that. Mm-hmm. Not really. Oh, yeah, I had one share called London and Liverpool. I can't remember how they came about. I think we was asked to take them up by a broker. And they were they were nothing, relatively nothing. And they went straight up. They got a new idea about putting TVs showing sporting programmes and programmes in the pubs. And the shares went from nothing, well, practically nothing, to £10. And I remember I did one big deal, and I wouldn't do the other half the deal. When they were about £6, I wouldn't buy any more. You know, I didn't like it. And so, of course, then, I just was over the weekend, and they used to get tipped every other week in the paper. Every other week, they were tipped. And I thought, it can't be. Because they didn't give no return on them whatsoever. And then suddenly, they went from, I came in on the Monday morning, there was a tip again, and I rung up my seller. I said, do you want to sell that quarter of a million? And he says, no. And they went straight to £10. I couldn't believe they'd ever get there. And then within a matter of weeks, they started plummeting down. And in the finish, you know, people must have lost a lot of money. And they went broke. Because it just wasn't catching on. The pubs weren't interested in it, and those that tried it out, didn't bring no more custom in, so of course they couldn't afford to keep the televisions. And they were getting all these televisions back. Mm. And they weren't just small televisions, they were the big ones, you know. And that one cost me a lot of money. Mm. That one cost me a lot of money.
Did you feel it was important to know much about the companies in whose stock you were dealing?
Yes. But I mean, although I didn't personally believe in going to talk to chairmen and that sort of thing. Well, I don't think I ever did. I only ever went once. And because I still think it's wrong today that chairmen should talk to people in the city. And the big boys always get to know everything before the small lads. This I always think did happen. And I still believe it does. I don't do much about it. I suppose they're entitled to know before the small man, really. But I don't believe that it gives the small man a chance because, you know, as you say, you pick up the paper yesterday and the share down 57p because the broker writes it out. So, but still, that's neither here nor there, really. But I didn't go to many companies. I used to go to see the brokers of the company and talk with them about it. But I mean, I don't think they knew too much about what was going on anyway. It might be around, you know, the year end, that sort of thing.
Mm. What was the value in going to talk to them?
Well, because I think that you found out what they were sort of, their ideas were on the stocks, which is always willing to listen to other people. You know, if you're dealing in the stock and you go and they used to have what we call brokers' lunches. And we used to go to the brokers and they used to have the clients, and they always have somebody there from the firm, and you used to talk to them. But I used to go to them quite a lot. Well, obviously one has to. But apart from that, I only ever visited one company. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't really learn much by walking around the company. Well, you walk around and see if they're busy or not, but then if they're not busy, the local people know anyway, and so they tell you.
What about other people in the firm? Did they have different ideas? Did they like to have contact with the companies?
Well, in the later years, you see, we used to have the analysts. Mm-hmm. Then they used to visit all the companies. So it wasn't necessary for any of them to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first started, the analysts were never heard of. Mm-hmm. But then in the 1970s, the analysts were there, and they used to, I mean, it was, there used to be more than one, there used to be four, five or six maybe. And they used to go to various parts of the country to visit these firms. So it wasn't necessary for partners or anything like that to, or the dealers concerned to go. Yeah. I mean, we all had the analysts. We all used to say, would you like to go and have a look at so-and-so and this other company, and you go and have a look at that one. And then when they could, they spend the day up there, and when they come back, they write an essay and give us their view on the thing. But what apart from that, wasn't necessary for other people to go.
What about the older jobbers, people you'd started with, like Pat Dulacker? Did they feel it was useful to know something about the company, or were they really people who stayed within the walls of the stock exchange?
Well, no, they stayed within the walls of the stock exchange, but they felt that, you know, in the latter years, obviously, that it was beneficial, because otherwise other people were doing it. Yeah. So no matter how old-fashioned you were, or you were, it had to be done, and gradually the whole system changed that everybody was going.
Did the brokers ever come to you for information about?
Oh yes, I have a lot, hell of a lot. And what I used to do in the finish, I used to put them onto the, ring up my stats, you know, stats man, and have words with him. Mm. You know, especially, you know, you could either say to him, well, he only went there yesterday, or he went there, you know, two or three weeks ago. Mm. And you can sort of have a chat with him about it. Mm.
This continued right through to when you retired?
No, not really, because then, you see, then they started, they all had their own ideas, they had their own stats people, and they used to, and everybody was a stats man, basically, except the people on the floor of the house, making the prices.
What were the kind of things they'd want to know about?
Well, they wanted to know what, basically, really, all they really wanted to know was what you thought of the company. They most probably, when they were asking you the question, they had their own views anyway. But I suppose the reason for that being that if it differed from mine or from theirs, then they might say, you know, well, why do you say this and why do you say that? Mm. So, of course, it might have, if it didn't agree, and I suppose they got two answers, so therefore they got put it into one. Mm. So I think from that point of view, and don't forget also, I think being a jobber and a partner in a jobbing firm, you most probably do talk to some of the people you know, like Slater Walker. I mean, I used to talk to Jim Slater quite a bit. And see, I mean, if you do that, then you can sort of have something to say about a company. But not too often, because there were never any secrets given away by chairman anyway. You know, and obviously never any secrets given away by me. Because we didn't get any, you know, because we never spoke to the chairman. I mean, always, you know, you only speak to the chairman when you go to lunches and that sort of thing. So from that point of view, I don't think that we learnt too much from the chairman in those days, not like it is today. You know, I think today, I mean, the chairman says everything, doesn't he, from what I can gather. Mm. So maybe that's why.
Now, as things progressed with you, were you being moved around from one pitch to the other, or did you basically stay on the same pitch?
No, I stayed on industrials until 1974, And then I went on to the South African gold mines. So there was a, they came with us through a firm called Blackwell, mm-hmm. who we took over. And as the market in the industrials wasn't absolutely brilliant at the time, so I went on to the South African gold mines. And I must confess, I wish I hadn't.
Mm. Why is that? Was it a difficult transition from industrial?
Absolutely. So different, you know, because on the industrials, all you're dealing with London, or you're dealing with England, and possibly America and something like that. But at least you knew what was going on in the English stocks. But in the South African stocks, you could be dealing with Johannesburg, America, all over the world. And nobody knew, or at least of all me, that's all fact, knew what was going on in any of them. So, of course, I was trying to be brave there, making fives and tens and twenties and fifties. And it just cost me a lot of money. And I mean a lot of money. I think I did it for about 18 months, I think. And I won't put on record how much it cost me, but it did cost me a lot of money. And I really had no idea how, because it started off terrific. You know, and I thought, so I'll carry on a bit. But then, of course, you were getting these people from America or South Africa coming on to what they call the arbitrage people. Mm. And, of course, they were kicking me from here to hell and back. And it really was absolutely ghastly. We gave them up after a while. I gave it up before, I think, actually. But then we packed it up altogether because you want to kick up the backside for nothing. Because you couldn't trust the people from outside. Whereas if you've got a London broker who wants to deal in English stocks, you could trust him. You know, he'd come up to you and tell you, depending on your reputation, and you know, if he was honest enough, which most of them were, they'd come up and tell you what they want to do in big lines of stock. And they said, if you sell me 100,000 of these, I'll leave you another order of 500,000. And it was left that way. Nobody knew about the business. You see, where today, I mean, from what I can read in the papers today, everybody knows there's a big order around within 2 minutes. Mm. Whereas then, you could, you know, and as I'm saying, in the 1970s, you could have an order in the market there, leave it with a jobber, and nobody knows anything about it for, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days. And that's the difference today. We never talked about orders in those days. We never changed the price. Mm. And if we managed to do it to the beneficial, to the broker, then we'd give him the sort of turn back. So from that point of view, it was absolutely brilliant because nobody knew what business you had. And if you bought 500,000 shares and you didn't want anybody to know, you didn't want to offer them, you thought, well, it looks a good bargain, we'll keep those. And we run the price up, and you could do like that because nobody knew you had 500,000. Mm. Whereas today, no sooner is an order than 500,000 done, and the price on the screen's changing, everybody chases the price on the screen, and the poor jobber, I'll say that poor jobber, has got no chance of getting his stock back.
Mm.
And that was a big advantage, you know. And if you play poker, you can play the game of jobbing.
Do you think jobbers were gamblers,
absolutely.
Had that cast of mind?
Oh, yes, I'm absolutely, well, I say, I, from my point of view, I'm absolutely sure they were.
Mm.
Absolutely sure they were, because we used to have when we merged, we had a fellow named Sir Nigel Morden. He was absolutely first class at it. He could buy 500,000 or 1 million shares. Nobody would know. He didn't even put it in the book. So anybody looks over your shoulder at the book, you know, when you open it up, it's not even there. You put it in the end of the day. And nobody knew. And, you know, you could go along and you push the price up, and you make a fortune. And that's how it was done in those days, you see. People didn't know. You didn't have to book it in the book until you got up to the office in the afternoon. And so then you book it in.
Mm.
But it was a different game. But now, you know, nobody knew the prices. Well, they knew the prices you were making, but you can make any price you like. But nobody knew you did the deal. And a lot of it was on trust with the brokers concerned, because they sometimes pick you Sometimes I pick Smith Butler, sometimes I pick Pynchon or anybody like that, you know, if they think that is the best man to do the business with.
Mm.
Because they know they won't get sport by it. And I'm pretty sure, you know, nobody sport them because nobody knew anything about the business, going back a few years, because it was all done because the broker picked the man he knew, and the broker knew the people who could, you know, who could trust in certain shares. And that's how it went on. It was absolutely terrific.
Did brokers like to have particular jobbers to do certain kinds of business with?
Oh, yes, no question about it. Mm. Because, as I say, you know, because you see some people, I mean, you take any share you like, and you, if you made the price consistently in 25 and 50,000 shares at a time, and another jobber might make it only in tens and maybe 25s, well, if he's got a big order, he's going to go to the man who's already making it in 25 or 50,000. You see, because I mean, if he regularly does that, and then he says, well, I've got more chance with him, I think, so I'll go and do it with them. And more often than not, the business always got done.
Mm. Mm. Did you find in your case that there were particular brokers who would like you, Tommy Anderson, and would come up and deal with you more often than not?
Oh, yes. Well, it's depending, basically, really, on the price of the share you're making and the size you're making it in.
Yeah. So you basically had to be competitive.
Oh, absolutely competitive, yeah. The name didn't mean nothing unless you were competitive anyway.
Yeah.
You know, they don't just say, well, I'll go with Tommy because he's a friend of mine. No, that didn't work. You know, but what did work, if you were competitive and you make it in the market and the size of the market and possibly you got business on, which you weren't afraid to tell him anyway. And so that went on. So they don't just go to you just because you're a friend.
Mm.
No, that didn't mm. work.
Did you see cases where jobbers did sometimes get too close to brokers?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Not unless they were. No, because I think most of the jobbers, if the broker went to the jobber, he's got to be competitive and have the market. See, I mean, you didn't always be the market. What I mean by that is you weren't always making it in 50s and 100s. Sometimes you only made it in 10 because you wasn't sure what you wanted to do. So therefore, the man wouldn't come to you that day. He'd go elsewhere. But I don't think it was a question of friends going to there or whatever. They wouldn't come to me unless they thought I was the market, and they wouldn't go to Smith Brothers unless they thought he was the market.
Yeah. Just to wrap up the story about the African gold market, how long did you stay with that?
18 months, yes, 18 months, 2 years, 18 months, between 18 months and 2 years.
And then what happened?
Then I went back on the industrial market. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. And by that stage, did Durlacker have lots of different sort of small industrial pitches with different, dealing with different stocks?
Oh yes, we had quite a lot. I don't know how many stocks we dealt in, hundreds and hundreds then. A far cry from the day when we had 50. Oh yes, we was in all the industrial markets, engineering market, store market. In middle 1970s, yes, we had all of those.
Mm. Well, I want to ask you some more sort of general questions about jobbing and different aspects of jobbing. Did you have a particular approach? Did you prefer to be a bear jobber or a bull jobber or?
Well, I think I was known basically as a bear jobber, but that didn't. If there was a bear market going, and then I think that I was pretty good at being a bear jobber. But you could only do that on what the market was going to do. I mean, I wouldn't, if the market looked like going straight up, for example, which it did in after the slump in 74-6. Then you've got to turn yourself around, you know, and you've got to say, well, you're stupid this way, you've got to be a bull, otherwise it's going to cost you a fortune anyway. Mm. It didn't always work, but it does sometimes. But I think I was known basically as a bear man. Mm. But bulls, you can still be a bull even if you're a bear, you know, overall. So that was easy enough.
Mm.
You know, you could run either bull or a bear. But I used to run the bear book. I presume better than the bull book, I think, because I didn't mind selling bears because, you know, that was that way inclined. But it was, the whole business was absolute gamble or whatever.
Mm. Mm. Did takeovers or stake building figure much in your experience? Would brokers often ask you for, you know, assistance if they were trying to build up a stake in a company for a client?
No, I think it only happened once. Mm. Only happened once with me. And that was, I can't remember, middle 70s, I presume. Mm. Yeah, it must have been middle 70s. And Boko asked, you know, he said to me, look, he said, oh, I've had a word with my senior partner and he thinks you're going to be the best man to do this job. He said, I want to buy Babcock and Wilcox with the stock. And he said, I want to buy them. Mm. So I said, well, are you telling me I'm the only one? He said, yes. He said, my partner, senior partner says he thinks you could be the best man for it. And so I said, fair enough. So, you know, he said, carte blanche, whatever. But when you see, when you do that, they know that you're only going to take what they call the turn on the market. Mm. You know, you never sort of rip them off or anything like that.
Yeah.
And this was the only one I had. And I think the price didn't move for, for 2 months or more. Mm. And then suddenly, he bought a few, and suddenly the price got out. And they went up six shillings in one day. And but you see, you could keep it quiet then. Mm. If he kept quiet and the senior partner kept quiet and I kept quiet and just went on in a normal way. Mm.